My name is Andrew Woodrow Butcher. I'm one of the people who puts this day together. We're very excited to have you here. In the room right now, we have a lot of folks who are attending the Toronto Comic Arts Festival Librarian and Educator Day, which is what I specifically work on with Lindsay. We also have people who are here attending the Word Balloon Academy. And we also have people here for the CSSC conference. So welcome to everyone. Thank you so much. The other thing that I have to mention, I have a glamorous task of letting everyone know that the washrooms are in this set of rooms, just towards the back. So that's where they are. We will be explaining where the programs are as we go through the day. They're all on the sheets that you've got in the doorway. But basically, this is the epic room that we're in right now. So that's the stream of programming about nonfiction graphic novels. The middle room with the tiles, that is the prologue room. So that's Comics 101. That's our area for sort of foundational stuff about using comics in libraries and classrooms. And the back room, which you can see is sort of a large wooden wall, that's the novella room. Yes, that's the novella room, and that's where our Comics 201 stream will be throughout the day. So that's me, and thank you all for coming.
Hi. I want to thank enthusiastically our publishing partners, so Drowning Quarterly, First Second, Kids Can Press, No Brow, Penguin Random House Canada, Scholastic Canada, and Viz Media, all helped to make this possible. Also, the Toronto Public Library for hosting us and co-sponsoring TCAF, and as well as the Beguiling Books and Art on TCAF. So I guess we're going to have an introduction for our keynote.
Hi, I'm Kalea Rosner. I'm introducing our keynote speaker, who don't know who that is yet.
You're in for a surprise.
Like everybody else here, I suspect, I've known Ryan North's work for years as one of the sort of most recognizable and ubiquitous webcomics in the English language. If you live at all on the internet, you've definitely by this point seen Dinosaur Comics at least a few points in your Facebook scroll or on BuzzFeed. Or maybe you picked up Machine of Death when it was Amazon's bestseller, or you've been recently keeping up with the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl as North was, subsumed into the rolling machine of mainstream comics. But maybe there are other things that you missed, like the fact that starting this fall, North takes over writing Jughead, or the interesting Whispered Apologies anthology series where strangers were sort of unknowingly connected with one another to create comics. Or maybe you've read his page-by-page review of the novelization of Back to the Future, which I can't believe I spent like 2 hours reading last night. In any event, Ryan is really prolific, and his attitude towards his own work disguises the critical depth of the work that he does. So how best to go about sort of introducing him? I consider trying to be funny, that's kind of punching out my weight class, so I needed a different angle. Ryan himself tweeted to me this morning, just tell them I am cool and good, which seems true, but not a particularly helpful way for me to like foreground his work and its sort of importance to both culture writ large and the little niche but fertile and growing field of comic studies. So let me try to sort of frame it for you in terms of that academic perspective. This isn't the easiest way to get at him either, because so much of what makes Ryan's work important is masked by how extremely fun and funny his work is. His insights never quite feel like someone just dropped a truth bomb on your head. Instead, they give the impression of a truth that you've always known, sort of given a universal voice that's easy for you to consume and internalize and recapitulate. The lessons that Dinosaur Comics teaches us are small lessons, but integral. I can't speak for anyone else, but I'm usually too busy sort of laughing to notice that I've learned something about the way that we process our politics, or assert social status, or communicate with one another on every level from sort of romantic overture to semiotic structure. Structure, too, is an important part of what makes Ryan's work so interesting for study and discussion. Because Dinosaur Comics, as well as Machine of Death, as well as Whispers and Whispered Apologies, as well as even aspects of Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, all slavishly devote themselves to sort of certain mirthful structures that in their restrictions force innovation and new forms of reading experiences. There's a strong concordance between the rigid structure of dinosaur comics or Machine of Death and the event scores of the Fluxus art movement, which were projects where the artists set up objects in a room and then passed out little instructional cards to everyone who would enter on how they might consider making use of the objects. Or maybe it's more like a conceptual poetry exercise, where the writer sets up a series of parameters and then sees what kind of content can be generated within them, to sort of give himself and his collaborators a set of rules and see what everyone can produce while working within those parameters. Quite a lot, as it turns out. Finally, if I'm going to keep going on Ryan's work in comics and sort of scholarly importance, I'd be remiss not to mention the sort of most recent contribution with Beeple Squirrel Girl. Illustrated beautifully, interestingly, hilariously by Erica Henderson, I hope I'm not gushing too much when I say that Squirrel Girl is unequivocally my favorite superhero comic currently being published. Here we have a comic that's blurring the line between webcomic and print comic forms, while also challenging the trope of superhero comics. Though everything about Unbeatable Squirrel Girl is tongue-in-cheek, I actually have no doubt that Dorian Green could actually kick the butts of just about every other character in the Marvel Universe using a combination of computer science, sass, nuts, and friendship. She really is unbeatable. Meanwhile, the comic gives voices to many social thematics and what's going on under its own surface. But again, here we have a hard time accessing or putting into words what's so very important and heady about Squirrel Girl, because we're too busy laughing. Ryan's talk today is titled Humanity's Greatest Achievement, Comics. There's again something clearly tongue-in-cheek going on here, but again, I think it disguises the import and potential that this talk promises. In an interview from like 10 years ago that I dug up, North was asked if being a cartoonist was something he saw himself continuing career-wise. He responded, "People have asked me that before, like my girlfriend. The way I look at it, I could always get a job in programming. For now, I'm going to see where this takes me." This moment speaks to the same kind of unsuspecting insight that all of North's work carries with him. I don't know if he necessarily planned on it, but if comics are one of humanity's greatest achievements, then I think surely that Ryan must be one of comics' most interesting voices. Let's just hope he doesn't fall into any more holes. Please join me in welcoming Ryan.
Thanks, everyone. I was thinking, listening to that, wow, that introduction is going to be a tough act to follow. But yeah, that's me. I do Dinosaur Comics. It's the same six panels with different words, and I've been doing it for 13 years. Normally, when I say Dinosaur Comics is the same six panels with different words, I always preface that, or call that rather, with it's better than it sounds. And it looks like my presentation just completely crashed. So, one moment while I bring that back up. Amazing timing for this.
Do you mean to stand over there and tell you what it says?
It did come
out. Or will it come out?
It's coming back up.
Okay.
So, sorry about this, everyone. If you could give me a hand as a group, as a class, tell me when the mouse is close to that thing that says to enter you. Now, I want to hit the drop down beside it.
Over on the drop down. Towards you from the left.
Left.
Yeah. This is the right thing around.
That's good.
Yeah, that's right.
Yay.
Yay.
We did it. Now, let's listen to me some more. So, Dinosaur Comics. This is what Dinosaur Comics looks like. If it loads, it's a video of, there it is. This is 10 years of my life. It takes about a minute to go through. It's quite a thing to watch 10 minutes of your, or 10 years of your life go by in a minute. But this sort of underlines the way that I'm going. Beyond that, Shakespeare, one called Fear Not, one called Romeo and Juliet, which comes up this month. Both of those have illustrations for every ending done by cartoonists. Squirrel Girl is done by Garth Henderson, who's a terrific artist. I mention all of this just to give you sort of cartoonist credentials, because I don't want to talk about comics right away. I want to talk about something arguably more important than comics first. And it is something that I think you've probably thought about yourself. I'm just waiting for my work to finish. There we go, 10 years of my life, done. What I want to talk about is... I've seen this. Oh my God. All right, crowdsource again. How do I get to the next slide button? Can you see the mouse?
No, we're down too far.
Do you have arrow buttons on the thing that for
it? That's in the image.
Oh.
A little up.
So I want to talk about time travel. And time travel is something that I think we've all thought about. If you haven't, pardon me, the first thought you probably think of is, if you were hurled back in time, what would you change? And this is, you know, on the surface, there's a lot of pretty obvious answers that I'm sure we've all thought about. Maybe we go back in time and give ourselves lottery numbers. Make a lot of money. Maybe go back in time and fix some relationship that didn't work out the way you hoped. You said the right thing at the right moment, that's going to fix everything. Maybe you think, screw the relationship, it's going to go back in time and make out with my past self. Also, a super valid option. My wife asked me this question, what do you do if you go back in time a while back? And I thought about it, so I wanted to hear a serious answer. And after considering it, I realized that my answer basically boils down to two words, not much. And it's not because there's nothing I want to change, it's because I don't know how to change things. I've studied computer science, I have 2 degrees in computer science, and I can't build a computer. If I went back in time 500 years and someone gave me a laptop, I could build them a website. But I don't know how to build a computer from first principles. I know how logic gates are supposed to work, but I can't build one out of sticks and stones. And it's not just me, and I guarantee all of the fields you're in, if you were sent back in time and had to rebuild the future from first principles, you'd probably be pretty lost pretty quick. So I felt like an idiot because I had all this education and I didn't know enough to make myself a god in the past, which is clearly the point of being educated. So I took a while, and I thought a lot about the world, did a lot of research, and after a couple of months, I produced this, which is a time traveler cheat sheet. All the information you need to rebuild the present day, the low-hanging fruit of civilization, is on this image. So, you're done. You can now rebuild civilization in the past. Congratulations. I don't know if you have time machines, but if you do, bring this with you. It's real handy. So, now that we can make ourselves gods in the past, rulers of the world, the question is, what do we bring back first? Like, what do we invent? There's really neat stuff on this. One of them is the compass. Compass is a very simple invention, super useful. It tells you where Magnetic North is, which in most time periods is a pretty good approximation of geographic north. It's real that you have your lost in the woods. And they're not that hard to invent, right? It's just a piece of magnetic material mounted on a stick that can rotate freely, and you're done. So, these in our current history, in Greece around 500 BC, we started noticing that certain rocks got together, those stones, magnetic rocks. and didn't really do much with it. China, a couple years later, they made the same observation, but compasses only got invented in China in the 1180s. There's a huge time period when we could have invented that technology and when we did. Pasteurization is another great example. All the milk you buy in Canada is pasteurized by law, because pasteurization is a really good idea. It kills most of the microbes in the bacteria, or it kills most of the microbes in the milk, which makes it safer to drink, makes it last longer on the shelf, or hopefully in the fridge. And to pasteurize something, it's super easy. You just bring the liquid up to almost the boiling point and then stop. That's it. You've invented pasteurization. So easy. This idea shows up in China in the 1100s as a way to preserve wine, but only gains traction in France in the 1800s when it's rediscovered by Louis Pasteur, puts his name all over it. So, if you want to invent pasteurization, show up any time before the 1800s. And if you want to know who has a time machine, look for people taking notes right now. So there's probably a couple things you're noticing about these two technologies, compass and pasteurization. The first is that they're information-based. Once you have that idea, that sort of moment of insight that changes the world, you have all you need to invent the technology. Unlike, there's no previous inventions you need to come up with first to make this thing happen, which is great. The second thing you're probably noticing is the insanely long time period between when we could have invented these technologies and when we did. Looking at the compass, the compass, we know the rocks stick together in 500 BC, but I met the compass 1,000 years later. And the compass is not a hard invention. Like, the picture I showed you was a modern compass. You needed plastic, you needed tiny needles, I guess, need to be invented. All these technologies, but the first compasses weren't that. You invented a compass. All you need is a piece of rock that's magnetic and a string. You tie the rock to the string, the rock rotates freely, points toward the magnetic north. That's your compass. Something that simple, something so important to the world, and something that only required us to tie a rock to a string to invent, took us 1,500 years. Pasteurization is even worse. For that, you just need milk and fire. And milk, I mean, preferably not for humans, but it's not necessary. The time we have fire gives the equation of milk plus fire equals not dying. Between when we could have invented that and when we did, is 10,000 years. 10,000 years to invent pasteurization. We could have done it 10,000 years ago. Stephen Hawking once said the greatest proof that time travel isn't possible is that we're not being visited by tourists from the future. I'd refine that and say the greatest proof that time travel isn't happening well is our embarrassingly unoptimized timeline. We're not doing very well here. So, we know some good things to invent, and we know when to go back. So the question is, all right, you want to go back and invent the compass out of schedule? Terrific. That's going to be great. A lot of sailors are going to die. You're going to change the world for better. But the catch, as we all know, is that if you change the past, you change the future. And on those dates we just memorized about when things like pasteurization were invented are now wrong and incorrect. So, can we do better? What's the one invention, if we're going back in time once to change the past, what's the one technology to bring back kind of schedule? And bonus points if it's information-based, so we don't do anything else with it, the ideas of the invention, and super bonus points if we can do some timeline optimization while we're at it. And those of you who have used time travel to skip ahead to the end of this lecture know what the technology I'm going to describe is, but for those of you in this old-fashioned way, I'll give you some hints. You used it today. You probably used it before breakfast. It's a technology so fundamental that you were exposed to it within seconds of being born. It's being used here. But it's also being used here. And it's even being used here. And it's language. And language is a technology. You kind of think of it as something like mathematics, where it's some fundamental property of the universe that we're exploiting. But it's not. It's totally arbitrary, and we totally made it up. And the way to sort of illustrate that, as language being a human invention, is to look at how flawed language is. There's so many things that we could do in language better that we don't. In English, we built the whole language around gender being foregrounded. If I use a pronoun, it's he or she, and there's work towards the singular they, but that's the whole changing the technology to make it more inclusive. Other languages do things way more interesting. They program different information. In Turkish, you can, instead of programming gender, like we do when we say sentence with he or she in it, you can program how you learn the information, whether it's first-hand or you learn it second-hand, which honestly seems way more useful. And there is flaws in English that are oversized. There's no language on Earth, no natural language on the entire planet that uses as a pheno, as a sound you make words out of. Nobody does it. And that seems like a huge oversight to me. So you could write some really beautiful poetry. You have that often. So we know the technology we want to bring back, which is language. And the question is, how far back can we go to bring it back? With the concepts we know we have to show, at least show up after we notice the rocks stick together, so around 200 BC. What's the earliest point we can invent language for us? And to answer that question, we have to talk about something called anatomically modern humans, which are humans who are just like us. These are humans in the past whose bodies are identical to ours. If we took them from the past, brought them to the present, gave them to a set of parents, those parents would not be able to tell the difference. These humans, when we become humans, when we become ourselves, these anatomically modern humans show up about 200,000 years ago. But we're not quite all the way there yet, because there's something called behaviorally modern humans. And these behaviorally modern humans show up 50,000 years ago. Behaviorally modern humans are humans who, as you might guess, behave like us. And we know they behave like us because they start doing more complicated things. They're building society. They start hanging out in these larger communities. And the question is, what changed? And the answer is, we don't know for sure, but there's two theories. One is our brains changed. Our brains evolved in some way that isn't preserved in the fossil record. Our skeletons stayed exactly the same, but the brain somehow shifted, which seems sort of iffy to me. Another theory is that all that changed 50,000 years ago is we started talking to each other. We invented talking. And talking is half the technology of language. But what talking does is it lets you no longer be trapped alone in your body, which is so useful. And also, it lets you communicate in a precise way. Because you can communicate without language. A baby crying is communicating. A dog whining is communicating. But a baby's cry, I'm hungry, or I'm tired, or I'm bored, or I poop my pants. And all these get the same sort of cry. It's very hard to understand. But with language, the sentence, I poop my pants, means just one thing. I chose this slide because he looked like he had made some mistakes. That's a solid slide to go with. So we've got our start date for many talking, which is between 200,000 and 50,000 years ago. We're halfway there, but language obviously has two parts, talking and writing. And I want to sort of underscore how important writing is, because talking is great, but writing is greater. If you just have talking, you're left with an oral history. And an oral history means that information has to survive in humans, which means it gets distorted, it gets edited, incomplete facts get written away. But writing lets information survive outside of your body. It lets you talk with people who aren't even in earshot. For us, the most important thing about writing is it lets us recover the thoughts of someone who lived thousands of years ago, who didn't speak the language we spoke. If everyone who spoke that language is dead, with writing, we can still recover what these people thought, with Egyptian hieroglyphs being a great example of that. But more importantly, writing lets us pull off, it's really the astounding feat of shipping information around the world with no more difficulty or expense than shipping grain. It's actually easier because books don't go bad. Writing lets information survive the death of the host, the death of the civilization even, which is such a huge deal and such a great technology to have that I made this slide. Which is also the most awesome slide in the presentation because it has a skeleton and the word awesome on it. That's how you know it's awesome. So, hopefully I've convinced you that writing is also a good thing to have. And the question is now, well, we know when we could have invented writing, when did we actually invent writing? And that's actually a kind of complicated question, because we're not really sure. But we know that writing has been invented on Earth maybe 4 to 5 times. That's it. There's a lot of written languages on the planet today, but they're all evolved from other written languages. For instance, that idea that spark of insight that says, let's transform invisible sounds into visible shapes. So when have we done that? What have we found with that? The earliest one, maybe, was on Easter Island. When Europeans showed up there, they found people living on Easter Island, drawing shapes like this. It's called Ronga Ronga. And the catch is that no one was left alive on Easter Island who could read it. If this ever was writing, the people who had read it, writing was restrained to priests, people of high society, those had died in plagues and battles. And if they had invented writing, they had forgotten how to read it. And they were just making these shapes in almost sort of cargo cult. We did this as a cultural tradition, but the meaning of the words was lost. Which I hope you find as terrifying as I do. Because they could have mentioned writing and they lost it. Before that, writing was invented in Mesoamerica, and even before that in Mesopotamia. A little after Mesopotamia, the Chinese invented writing. This is early Chinese script on bone fragments. But this could easily, this was about 1,000 years after writing was invented in Mesopotamia, and this could easily be a case of the Mesopotamians not obeying the prime directive and culturally contaminating the Chinese, because it's not the particulars of writing that's hard, it's that idea of invisible sounds and visible shapes. Anyway, that's it. Those are the only times we invented writing on the planet. And the earliest invention of writing that Mesopotamians was in 3200 BC, 45,000 years after we started talking, 196,000 years after we became the humans we are today. So this is where it can have the single greatest effect on human history, if you have a time machine. Go back in time 196,000 years to these anatomically modern humans who are just beginning to become us, and teach them to talk, teach them to understand each other. And when you do, teach them to write their boss family. In the beginning, every civilization on Earth, 196,000 year head start. But I kind of cheated, because I'm talking about language, and there is one more part of language that is the next evolution, and it looks like this. It is comics. So in video games, we talk a lot about tech trees, where you need an invention to unlock another invention, and these inventions combine in different ways to give you further inventions. This is a complicated tech tree. The tech tree for comics is way simpler. It looks like this. You need rad bodies that give you talking. With talking, you can invent writing. And with writing and pictures, you can invent comics. The question is, well, when did we start drawing pictures? The answer is, we always drew pictures. They were a gimme. They were easy. This is a cave painting from way, way in the past. And in it, you can see there are some deer being hunted by some hunters. This isn't comics. This is just a picture on a cave. But it's very easy to turn it into comics. That's more balloons, and now it's a bunch of deer making action hero puns as they kill some hunters. These two slides jump 196,000 years in human technology. So, how do you invent comics? You define it. As we know, comics are juxtaposed, pictorial, and other images in linear sequence, such as here we have words and pictures in the linear sequence. And when you're looking at the history of comics, the most interesting thing, I think, is the history of the word balloon. Because it's so simple. I did that slide in 2 minutes, as you can probably tell. But to get there, I relied on, again, this gradual, slow process that we took towards inventing the word balloon. The earliest example I think of the word balloon you find in Mesoamerica around 650 BC. This is taken off of a clay jar, and on it you see a bird saying these shapes that represent a person's name. And those lines kind of look like a dialogue line. This is almost all the way there, but it didn't quite take. And the next time you see something approaching comics showing up, pardon me, is in Europe. We're in 1118 AD. And this picture is amazing because they don't have the word balloon. And so the workaround is already artist did was have people hold up signs saying what they wanted to say, which I love because you can see the thought process. You see, oh, well, we write down words, and when we speak, we say words, so we'll just hold signs the words we want to speak. A couple of years later, 1806, this painting shows someone speaking with a scroll spewing out of his mouth. And even the thought process, words on scrolls, if the scroll goes in the mouth, it would be like he was speaking. And so maybe this is how we represent sound in comics. And it's clearly not working that well. The woman in the picture is like not having anything. And it looks like he's vomiting up words. So this is here, back to Mesoamerica. This is around the same time before the Spanish show up. And this is a really fascinating picture, because what you have are two groups of people, and the people on the right are on boats, and they're coming towards people on the left. And you'll see these sort of question mark, cane-shaped things wiggling around. Those also represent scrolls. This is the same idea of scrolls being words representing sounds. And on the tip of those scrolls, you see these kind of red-white pill shapes. Those are actually daggers. Those daggers represent the idea of violence. This is showing that these people arrived on boats and were saying violent things towards them. So it's not quite a word balloon yet. You're still using the scroll as a sort of symbolic way to show what's going on, but the image of a tool representing what that tool can be used for is really neat. And what's super neat about this is that you don't need to speak the language to understand what they're saying. You need to understand the symbolism. You can recognize the object, you can go with it. Merida, 1776. We're starting getting towards more recognizable word balloons. The earliest ones before this were drawn on puffs of breath. If you ever go outside in the cold, you see your breath when you speak. Early artists would draw this breath and then cram in tiny little words, sort of fill them in, which evolved into this. And you can see this artist is not having a good time. The words are all at different angles. There's the one balloon at the edge here where you can see he clearly did this balloon first. And then you get this kind of same thing. This word just sort of go underneath it. Which makes no sense from a comics perspective because the visual representation of the words has nothing to do with the actual content of the words. He just crammed it in the page wherever he could. Which is obviously suboptimal. This is yellow in the early 1800s, or the late 1800s. 1898, I believe. Yellow Kid was one of the first newspaper comics, and the thing aside about the Yellow Kid is that it was printed in two newspapers, and these newspapers were very sensational, kind of tabloidy papers. And because these two papers had Yellow Kid in it, that style of journalism became known as Yellow Kid journalism, which was shortened into Yellow Journalism, which we still use today. But the Yellow Kid, as an early comic, is fascinating because he never spoke. Instead, he had a magic nightgown that when he wanted to speak, words would magically appear on it. And this one, he runs in the store, it's a paint store. When he comes out, his shirt says, "Golly gee, you ought to see the Otter Kid say I didn't do a thing to him." Which is amazing. I love the idea of, we don't have the word balloon quite yet, it's not quite working. Let's just give the guy a magic shirt. And as the Yellow Kid went on, other characters showed up and started using word balloons, but Yellow Kid always just stayed with his magic t-shirt. So America in the 1940s, the word balloon is now more and more established, and you start seeing artists realize that it doesn't just represent invisible sound in visible shapes, it represents how the sound is understood. This comic is really cool because in the middle panel is a shot from outside, and you see the word balloons occluded by the window. You can still read what they're saying, but it takes some effort, which mirrors perfectly how you can still hear what people are saying, but it takes some effort when you're eavesdropping through a window. So what you're seeing here is a transition from we just need to get the sound on this paper to wait a minute, what if we could show how that sound on the paper was heard? This continues into the modern era. On the left, these are images from Scott Mather's Day Comics. And you can see the shape of the word balloon is not telling you something about how the words are said. The icy one is clearly someone who's feeling very cool towards you. The explodey one is anger. Different things being shown in different shapes of word balloons, reaching its more ultimate expression. On the right is a comic from Dixon, and he's clearly ordering a cup of coffee. It's the exact same thing that Native Americans were doing in the 1500s. The symbol of the coffee tells you what you say, just as the symbol of the dagger tells you what they're saying. Anyone who has seen a cup of coffee can read this comic and know what's going on, which is powerful. These are images from Dan Close. More advanced curriculum usage. On the left is a character who is being interrupted by someone trying to talk about Polaris Cat's climate change. And to show that he's interrupting him, his word balloon goes on top of the other one. And the second panel, the guy says climate change. As soon as he says those words, he laughs and cuts him off. And you know that because his word balloons are overlapping it. The bottom one is even more advanced. It's someone on the first date, and the yellow narration box represents their inner dialogue. And the guy is so caught up in his own thoughts, his own neuroses, that he can't even hear what he's saying. And as a reader, you don't know either. You're put right in the position being like, what did she say? Oh, crap. Jesus, I'm plastered, sober up. Like, you're right with the character in that moment. And this is done through word balloon placement and narration box placement, which I hope illustrates how the technology of word balloons, the technology of comics, has evolved and is still evolving. This is a Dutch comic. I didn't write it, my friend Andrew did. The catch with this comic is every few seconds, the panel change. So the comic you read depends on the speed at which you read it. It's maddening and it's madness. I say this is probably an evolutionary dead end of comics because it's very frustrating to read something and have it be whipped up from beneath you. But it's exploring the form and doing new things, this idea of words and pictures together on the page. Here's another one from Adventure Time comic I did. That's a choose your own path comic. So you can decide as a reader what happens next. And what's fascinating about doing this in comic form is that in the choose your own adventure books we all have for kids, it would say turn to page 7, and you would turn to page 7 and you'd miss what was in between. But in a comic, you see the full page, you always know what's going on, and so you know what you're missing, and you can take advantage of that as a writer by writing it such that you know the player, or the reader, is going to be following both paths in a situation like this. And since they know they're often both led to the same point, you can have some jokes with that and be like, wow, I feel like this was somehow inevitable that I would get beat up. So, moving on to webcomics, this is an example from A Softer World by my friends Joey and Emily, and the XKC by Hal Randy. Both of these comics, and a lot of webcomics, have something called alt text, or more technically, title text, which are secondary, hidden, secret punchlines that show up when you hover your mouse over the image. And this is really neat because it's intrinsic to the art, it's intrinsic to the stuff that Randy and Joey and Emily are doing, but it lives online, it's native to the form online. And when they do books, Joey and Emily print their alt text upside down beneath the comic. I put mine in the back in the index. But this is backporting that advance, that technology, to print. This is another example from Inkwood, which I put on because it mentions libraries. But it's, let's read it, because I always like reading comics. So it says, yeah, I set it up. The second monitor says, that's what's happening on Ray's computer. And the other cat, Rose Beach, says, dang, this is like looking over his shoulder in real time. Weird, just Googled for pictures of Mount Everest and made it his desktop. Now he's Googling for a picture of a motorcycle. He chooses one, shrinks the browser down real small, and then rants motorcycle. Over the ground, and the alt text is, four kids left playing this game in the library. Which is real sad, but that's Inkwood. So, this is the tech tree for comics. This is how we get there. This is how we've gotten there. And the reason this talk is saying that it's the greatest form of writing is that I kind of think it is, in all seriousness. This is a book, and this is a book of comics. A book of prose and a book of comics. Show this image to anyone and ask them which looks like it's going to be more fun to read. It's going to be this one. Comics is an intrinsically fun medium. In the way movies are intrinsically entertaining to watch, comics are intrinsically entertaining to read. I know as librarians and educators, we all say that books are fun. And they are, but comics are funner. They're also more easy to understand. When in a comic, the words support the pictures and the pictures support the words. A lot of people who are learning a second language will read comics because if you don't understand what the character is saying, the words can give you a clue. It's easy to understand Western community when you have two chances to do it. They're both working towards the same goal. They're also accessible. They're so inviting, just comparing these two books. And I kind of cheated because one is a book, I think it's a German Bible, it looks so boring. And one has colors and shapes and explosions. But anyone can pick up a comic, even if you can't read, and you can still follow the pictures. Just like we saw in those Sonic comics, where you need to have no language, you need those symbology. And they're also the ultimate form of British, right? To sort of underline this, I want to point out that whenever we want something to be read, whenever we think something's really important to be read by people, we tend to go towards comics. Here are a bunch of examples. This is on the left, propaganda aircraft over Nicaragua on the CIA in the 80s. They dropped comics because they thought people, random citizens, were more likely to pick up and read a comic on their own than a pamphlet, which I feel like is true. This one is amazing. It's a comic for US military members sent by the pre-war committees. The comic was given to people who were in Korea is called, "What Am I Doing Here?" And explain to the enlisted members what they're doing there in Korea, like why this war is important. And that was in comics form because they wanted to be read. There's a Superman comic from the 90s that was distributed to kids that taught them, here's how to be safe around landmines because we put a lot of landmines in Bosnia. Here's how not to get killed by them. And the last one is a comic book of the life of Franklin Roosevelt published in the 40s during World War II. It's about young Roosevelt. He's a kid. How all-American he is, how tough he is, how he's super American. And the controversy with this was it was supposed to be a pro-war comic, and it became a pro-Roosevelt comic. But the interesting thing is that it was in comic form. It was designed to be read by people. They wanted random citizens, as much as possible, to read it. So rather than read, you know, an essay on Roosevelt, which sounds so boring, they made a comic about young Roosevelt, which I want to read. He's going to wrestle a bear. It's going to be great. Here on the left, this is by Will Eisner, it's a perfect cartoonist. It's called How to Skip Your Baby. It's the 50s, the 60s, sorry. It's given to everyone when they got their rifle in Vietnam. Every soldier got one of these. With a busty blonde using sexually suggestive language to explain how to use your gun. Here's how you take it apart, here's how you keep it clean. They wanted enlisted men to read this, so they put it in comics form, and they put drawings of pretty ladies who explain it and use some weird suggestive, like, strip your baby doesn't sound attractive to me at all. But the point is, it was comics. They want to be rich, they want to be comics. On the right, this is still going. This is a comic given to people in the Navy in Iraq to help with PTSD and the stress of combat deployments. It's a 200-page graphic novel showing three different characters, three different enlisted men. I think one's a woman, actually, it's more modern. Dealing with the problems that enlisted people would encounter while they're in Iraq. And again, comics, they wanted to be read. It was fun. Now, these aren't comics, these are warning signs, but it's the same idea. When something's important, let's put words and pictures together. The ones on the right, the bottom right, there's two ones there, are actually not real ones. My friend made them. They say, I heard they come to me, they say, warning, this device contains atoms. This is technically true of most devices. And there was this warning, lasers are awesome. Again, technically true of everything. But the fact that we use words and pictures when we're talking about life-threatening situations, I think shows that as humans, we find words and pictures together intrinsically interesting. So, we're all here for TCAF. TCAF is my favorite festival. It's so great. And what I love about it is that it introduces comics, not just people who already like comics, people who don't even know about it. This is held in the reference library, and there's no admission. You have people wander in who are like, what is this show? Tell me what you do. And I start walking into something about Dynasty Comics, they're like, no, what are these comics? Like, what are comics? Introduce me to the medium, which is terrific. It's so good. And seeing, I hope I made the argument that if you go back in time, you should bring back comics. But I also want to propose a new slogan for TCAF, which is TCAF combination of 100,000 years and just 196,000 years. So yeah, if you ever see access to a time machine, think of me, go back in time, fix our technological developments. We don't waste 196,000 years on not talking to each other, not writing our thoughts down, not making comics for each other, which, as we saw, is the greatest form of written expression in the universe so far. And when you do go back in time, please bring some comics for you. That's it. Thank you.
I think, you know, TCAP is like the greatest festival of its kind, and I think Educators Day is the best day because it's about getting comics into schools and schools into comics. And it's an enormous source of frustration for comics creators and educators that, like, almost 20 years after Mouse won a Pulitzer, you still see articles that start biff, bam, pow, comics, not just for kids anymore. Yeah. And there's still so much resistance to the idea that words and pictures are a much better way of engaging audiences and telling a story. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so my question was sort of talking about how, even though there have been seminal works in comics that are written for adults, you still see Harkison's bit there, how comics just don't for kids anymore. And it is frustrating because there's this idea that comics are for kids, and if you read them, you're reading some juvenilia. And the idea is you give kids picture books, and then they graduate to word books with some words in them, and they graduate to words to books with just words in them. And comics, when they're together, seem like this weird sidestep that you must be an emotionally centered man child within your parents' basement to enjoy. And it's not true. But I feel like this is a thing that is more distinctly North American than worldwide Japan. There's a much greater comics culture to it. And honestly, this is a bit self-serving because I do webcomics. I feel like webcomics is changing that. Because if you're living in North America before the internet, so the past 20 years before that, and you don't seek comics out, you don't go to comic stores. You'll only really see them from three places. You'll see them in the newspaper strips, you'll see Archie and Jughead at the cash checkout at grocery stores. It'll be culturally aware of Superman and Batman through just cultural osmosis. They're everywhere, there are lunchboxes, there are movies and stuff. And those are three particular genres. There are newspaper strips, which, by their nature, are designed not to offend, so very safe jokes, generally about mundane and lasagna. Which is a very distinct sense of humor. There's jokes about teen romance, there's jokes about superhero power fantasies. And I love superhero power fantasies, I'm all about them. But I recognize that these are distinct genres. These are one, three things. It always makes me think of this idea of a small town with one movie theater in it. And you grow up in this small town. And the trick is that the movie theater only ever shows romantic comedies. So you go to the movie when you're a kid, you see a romantic comedy, and you think, that wasn't for me, but I'll see another movie. And you go back year after year as you grow, and you keep seeing romantic comedies, and you keep not liking them. And after 20 years of going to this movie theater, it'd be fair if you walked in and said, I think I don't like movies. Because all you've seen are one particular genre of movies. I feel like that's where comics were in America for a long time. People would be like, I don't like superheroes, so I don't like comics. And webcomics really want to change that because they're so accessible. You don't have to go into a comic book store to read them. You can get sent to them by a friend, Facebook, Twitter, email links. And all you have to do is click it and read it. It's so accessible. And I get emails, I used to, I still do, get emails from people saying, hey, I don't like comics, but I like dinosaur comics. So good work on that. Very fact, like, surprise, you like comics, it's all comics. Just because they're not men and types punching each other doesn't mean it's not comics. So I feel like because of the internet, because comics have sort of gotten out of this ghetto they've been for a long time of comic book stores, right? That's always been together. We're sort of losing that idea of comics are for losers or comics are for nerds. And switching more into, this is a medium like any other. And does it sound ludicrous to say, I don't like comics, or I don't like movies, I don't like books, I don't like talking? It will hopefully soon sound ludicrous to sound to say, I don't like comics. That's my hope anyway. Another question?
We talk about the universality of reading comics, how accessible it is, but what about the progression of a universality of making comics to communicate? I think we're just starting that in education, starting starting to say, you can make this project a historical report as a comic, because we're not really looking at how are comics composed as decisions, right?
Yeah.
How do we decide to communicate this with words and pictures? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so the question was about the use of comics in sort of a nonfiction environment and how we're using them more and more as ways to express ideas than just comics as a whole.
Well, we're reading them and we're engaging with reading them in the classroom, but maybe not making them,
right,
which is a different skill set altogether.
Absolutely. The good news is it's not a hard skill set to learn. I'm a guy who can't draw, and I can still force my way through. But the thing that I find so exciting about more and more people making comics, like amateurs making comics, same way amateurs write. People don't consider themselves writers when they make a Facebook update for their friends, but they're writing, they're engaging with text. And we're seeing more people just doing comics to express ideas, which is terrific. My fantasy is to go to a bookstore. My fantasy used to be to go to a bookstore and see comics. And that's happened. My dream has come true. My new fantasy is going to a bookstore and see comics that aren't in a comic section, that are distributed amongst all the other books. Because, again, it's a medium, not a genre, and it seems so crazy going to a bookstore. There's your supernatural romances where there's vampires that sparkle and bite each other. And here's your, you know, nonfiction World War II histories. And here's your graphic novels. And there's a difference. That's genre, medium. And you look at this graphic novel section, and you've got stuff like Raina's Tomar's Smile, which is a really good autobiography, next to Dark Knight Returns, which is men and tights punching each other. And they don't belong side by side. They belong next to the other autobiography books and superhero books. So I guess to speak to that, my hope is that, again, as comics get more accessible, more and more people find out that there's no magic to it. You can do it. Anyone can do it. And this leads to them being used as a medium, not a genre. So I want to express something, and I consider doing it in a screenplay, or I write a book, or I might do comics. These are all equally valid ways to do it, which is, I think, good. I like comics, you guys. I'm in favor of questions? Yeah.
Okay, so we're all thinking about like the Edward comics that like I guess like it kind of starts off as kind of like this like really like layer shift, like, you know, oh, it's the same family over again with different text. Spend out over 10 years and it becomes something like completely different, like it takes on a whole different meaning and like it's produced. So like for you as like a comic creator or a writer, like what do you think you kinda like took away from that experience about like both making comics and comics as a whole, kinda like having the discipline to stick with something like that and not only like evolve that idea of one thing at the beginning and something else like another path later, and also like having a discipline to stick with that and say, I'm going to keep doing this and never saying like I'm going to stop it every day, just saying like I'm gonna keep doing this.
Right. So the question about comics, like how do you stay ahead of it and evolve over time? When I started, and the advantage of master comics for as a guy who wanted to do comics and couldn't draw is that I sidestepped that whole issue. But if you look at the early master comics, and I'm telling you this as a friend, I don't think they're very good. It took practice to get better. And what I realized as I was writing it over time was that, A, I never have to face a blank sheet of paper. I know that T-Rex is probably going to be in my comic since he's there in 6 panels. And also, it's almost like haiku where you've got constraints and you work within those constraints. And it gives you a wall to bounce off of or play with or incorporate or ignore or do anything with, but you've always got something you can play with, which is great when you're having to write a comic every day. But as time went on, it sort of changed the gaze from, oh, this guy used to take pictures. How long can you keep that up? I feel like after a 5-year mark, you're like, well, you can keep it up for a while. that question's answered. And it became, how flexible is this layout? How can you keep telling new stories with these same 6 panels? And the magic of comics that makes this possible is that between panels, there can be any amount of time, and in panels, there can be any amount of time. So if you have a panel with just, say, T-Rex in it, and he says, hi, that panel takes 1 second of story time. But if I put in a bunch of words, if you say, hi, my name's T-Rex, I'm a dinosaur, blah, 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 that can take, you know, up to a minute of story time. And so no matter how many words I put into it, it always reads straight. Can you imagine doing this with video, where you have someone talking, you replace the audio, you can't pull off that trick because I have to talk for as long as that person's mouth is moving. And you can do the joke of hi, and the person's mouth moving, and there's only says one thing. That joke only works once. You can't keep it open for 2 years. So for me, it's been a journey of discovering how flexible comics are and how much you can work with just six panels for 13 years. I can still find new stuff to tell with those six panels, which I think is proof that comics is an incredibly versatile way to tell stories. I think we've got time for one more question. At the back. No, you.
As you're moving kind of from this dinosaur comics thing, which is like very clearly your project that you have like godlike powers over, to things within the Marvel universe, or like doing Adventure Time comics where there's like, I assume more people invested in what that looks like and more control over what you're doing. How has that changed you as a writer and working with other people? Like, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, as a writer, the greatest joy is seeing the script you've written come back as heads of the artist group. Because, and I said this before, in comics, the writer has an easy job. Because I can say, on this page, Squirrel Girl fights 1,000 ninjas. 10 seconds to write, I press my hands off. Good work today, Ryan. But that'll take Erica a day or more to draw. And so your goal as a writer is to write scripts that are interesting and fun for the artist to draw. And so it's so fun for me, especially after spending a decade with the same pictures, to just write down something and have it be drawn. Like, it feels every time like I've cheated somehow. Like Marvel picture, but I should pay her too. She's doing such great work. But in terms of writing for characters that other people care about, where they have a say, it's funny because I got the job of writing Squirrel Girl. I pitched and they said, sure, go for it. And the catch was that I didn't read a bunch of Marvel comics when I was a kid. I read Batman comics. And so I didn't know the Marvel universe. I didn't know the characters or the bad guys were even. If you look at the first four issues of Squirrel Girl, everybody she fights has been in a Marvel movie. Because I saw the movies, like, well, I know these guys, and look at this. And it's fun because there are these people that have stakes in the characters. And so I say, I want to use Captain America, and you want to have Squirrel Girl beat up Captain America because he's mind controlled, and that's a great thing to beat someone up for. And my editor said, sure, let me check with the Captain America office. And I'm not sure what that office is like. Imagine it's like Captain America has an office. You're like, hey, Cap, you want to get beat up by Squirrel Girl? He's like, sure thing. But the message came back, they're fine with it, but just so you know, Captain America, who became Captain America, as you might know in the movies, by having super soldier serum injected into him in the 50s, just so you know, he's had that sucked out of him, and he's an old man now with no powers. So I said, okay, I guess Squirrel Girl won't beat up an old man with no powers. Just kind of rough. And then the email chain, my editor's editor popped up, and was like, well, Steve Rogers is still a really tough guy. He's no slouch in the fighting department. I said, okay, so she will beat up Steve Rogers. And she did. The only change she made was on the cover, we have all the Avengers, Better Cut Squirrel Girl, and the photograph had Steve Rogers knocked out behind her, but it looked too mean. She beat up an old man. So a lot of fun is you're writing for other characters, but the universe around you has a bunch of other writing at the same time, and you're all kind of adjusting for each other. And making allowances. And, oh, you're pregnant. Just so you know, he's immoral right now. Okay, I'll probably sure not to kill him. It's fine. So yeah, it's fun. It's fun to play people's toys. But I think the reason it works so well is that it gives you a lot of freedom to do stuff and to have a girl with squirrel powers beat up everyone. It's a fun story, right? I'd lie if we have one more question. Last question. That's a good one.
When I'm teaching writing, I always tell my students how important it is that they have an audience in mind. But when I read Squirrel Girl, I feel like I'm your intended audience. I'm a 45-year-old woman. But my son, who's 11, feels like he's your intended audience. So I was wondering, do you have an audience in mind? And do you think that's even important?
That's a great question. When I'm writing, I always try to write for myself. And I mostly write comedy. And the secret to writing comedy is to write alone. Because what I do is I'm sitting there on the computer and I'm trying to write jokes that make me laugh. Because if I think it's funny, hopefully other people share my sense of humor. But you look like the biggest loser who's sitting at a coffee shop going, oh. Good joke. So I always write when no one's around me because I'm literally trying to make myself laugh. And I was asked this question, a similar question, I was doing an interview with my high school newspaper, my university newspaper, and they said, you know, who's your audience? How do you find them? And I said, oh, well, my trick is I don't. I write for myself, and I'm trying to write for anyone who shares my sense of humor. That's the hope that what I think is funny, that other people think is funny, too. And they printed that as writing for anyone who has a sense of humor. Way more difficult to say. It's another interview with the same paper, I think. They said, like, where do you get your ideas? And I said, oh, well, if I ever get stuck, I have this giant text file of snippets of dialogue or things I'd like to explore. So if I hit a wall, I can look at that unfinished script, something to play with. And they said, oh, that's great, super. That interview went to press through print and web. Like, there were layers of editorial there. And my answer changed to, I have a giant text file, like a rug, on my wall that I look at. And it inspires me. Such a better answer. Like, that's the new official history. The text file is a secret.
Now you can put that in your text file.
Yeah. To answer your question, I write because I have a magic rug.
That's
so,
my travel.
Exactly. So yeah, thank you all for coming. I'm having a good time, and I hope that by using time travel as a lens, I've sort of convinced you that writing, talking, language is a technology. Comics is a technology, something we invented. It's still evolving, and it's something we should really keep around. Thank you very much.